Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today I am joined by Word Up podcast favorite, Robert Forte. Robert Forte is a psychedelic scholar, an author, an editor, and a dear friend of mine. I'm so excited for the show, which has been a couple years of prodding in the making, and in the face of the FDA's recent decision to not approve the MAPS MDMA trauma therapy proposal, Robert asked to come on the show to set the record straight about MDMA, Rick Doblin, MAPS, and the whole psychedelic movement around MDMA. I've done a number of shows with Robert Forte around the history of psychedelics. Emily Moyer and I have done a whole series called Psychedelic Fascism with Robert Forte. This particular conversation is one that I'm so excited is finally going on the record, because in my several years long friendship with Robert, I've been hearing stories behind the scenes about what really went down with MDMA, Doblin, and MAPS. And I'm thrilled that now is the time that Robert has decided to come forth and share his lived experiences with you, me, and all of us. Before we dive into today's super, super juicy conversation, I'm reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment. Also inviting you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. That does it for housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy my conversation with Robert Forte. Robert Forte, my friend, welcome back to the Word Up podcast. We've missed you here. How are you, my friend?
Danny, it's so nice to see you. I'm good. I'm on a visit to the United States after being gone for almost a whole year in New England. Fall colors just starting. I feel great.
Perfect time for you to be back. How does it feel here in the United States of America Corporation after a year of a respite?
I am telling you, I am just in this, you know, one of my favorite lines from the mythical Jesus was, unless you become like little children, can you enter the kingdom of God? Mm-hmm. And I've just been feeling more and more childlike. My friends will say, Bob, you've always been very childlike. But, you know, being in Greece for a year where I can't read the language, I can't speak the language, I can't understand any words. Unlike if I go to Italy or Mexico, you know, or France, I can get some of it. But Greek is totally, so it's Greek. Like Greek, it's Greek. And so you feel on a different level, you know, your mind isn't quite as active. And then again, coming back here to where I'm from, Vermont, Boston, New York, just with fresh eyes, and everything seems exciting to me. And I'm really loving it. And I'm especially glad that you and I can get to have this conversation, this really long overdue conversation. You know, we've had a few really good conversations about psychedelic drugs and mind control and the yin and the yang of psychedelics. But, you know, over the past few months, there's been so much media attention to this, the FDA's decision and MDMA and the history of MAPS. And so I joined Twitter to kind of follow that, because that's a subject, you know, I've been very, very involved with since the very beginning of my career as a psychedelic scholar, and particularly with MAPS and MDMA, that I just think it's, you know, I'm on Twitter. I've just made a few kind of snide comments. I'm reading all the media, and I just think it's time for a really full download to educate people that are being sort of superficially informed by the media. And it's a really good opportunity for us to take a deep look at drug policy, in particular regards to MDMA, and just so people are aware. So
Yeah, I'm excited that we get to do this because you and I have obviously been talking about this amongst ourselves for years. I know your history from the very beginnings of MDMA's introduction into our culture here in the States. And then when everything blew up with the FDA over the past few months, and then seeing this like kind of public outcry around the decision without, even a smidgen of the details as to what this is really about. I'm excited that you're finally here to walk us through it. Do you want to start at the beginning, at the very, very beginning of your relationship with MDMA?
Yeah, we could do that. I mean, first, a general comment I want to make is that it is what is it? It's astonishing. It's heartbreaking. This substance, MDMA, is as most everyone who has taken it in the optimal circumstances knows that this is a marvelous and unique and powerful and extremely valuable substance to heal wounds, to explore consciousness, to recreate, to experience love and sanity. This is one of the most important tools in the psychedelic toolbox. Fantastic, fantastic, consistent experiences, as I said, in optimal circumstances. And to see what has happened to this drug since I first started working with it 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago, 40, it's been 43 years now that I had my first MDMA, and got very involved with it. To see what's happened, how this amazing drug has been squandered by faulty, deceptive, fraudulent drug policy and a few very conniving individuals that have aligned themselves with a very corrupt system of drug policy in the United States. So I want to say that first. This FDA decision, which we're going to get to, is many people, people that I really respect, Bobby Kennedy is one. I know you and I have our differences there, and I'm changed a lot, but I still really respect a lot of what comes out of his mind and heart. Was lamenting this decision by the FDA. A lot of people are lamenting the decision on the FDA. And look, I'm not a great fan of the FDA. That's part of this very corrupt medical, pharmaceutical conspiracies in our country. But this was the right decision. It's
Yes.
being mis it's being misnamed in the press that the FDA rejected MDMA or rejected MDMA therapy. But they didn't reject MDMA or MDMA therapy. What they rejected, and this is really important to distinguish, is they rejected the MAPS-Lykos application to monopolize MDMA for good reasons. That MAPS application was fraught with scientific fraud, sexual abuse, manipulation, cultism, faulty practices, for so many good reasons. They rejected it. Not only did they reject it, but the journals that had previously published positive results from the MAPS-Lykos, I'm going to call it a scam, and I'll explain that. From the MAPS-Lykos scam, they withdrew their published data because they were informed of a lot of this stuff behind the scenes of this corrupt practice. So this is a very, very good decision by the FDA, and it gives us in the community an opportunity to move forward. And so I want to conclude our conversation when we get to at the end that with some ideas like what to do next. How can we recover the value of this medicine to really advance human consciousness and advance our society, because that really needs to happen. So that's my first offering.
I love that. I love your first offering, and I know we'll get there. I don't want to go out of order. And because you brought up Bobby Kennedy, and I know Joe Rogan was also quite vocal in criticizing this decision. But one thing that didn't sit right with me is that I know that you were advising Bobby Kennedy's psychedelic advisor as to what was really going on with those studies, which you and I both know firsthand. So I found it odd that even with very clear advice from probably, you know, the person who I would say is most qualified to talk about right use of MDMA in our culture now, he still went ahead and made the public statement that he made, which for me, just in terms of tracking the Bobby op and the parts of him that we love and are so excited about, and then the parts that just do not make any sense, this was one of those pieces that for me made no sense, understanding that his advisor had been educated as to why this was a good decision.
Okay, let me just correct that a little bit. You know, my conversation with one of Bobby's senior advisors,
yep,
was who called me and asked me for some ideas because he was going to be speaking at a conference about how Bobby might integrate changes drug policy in his administration. And so we spoke really just generally about psychedelic research. And we spoke about the Controlled Substance Act, which is something to be changed. And that's something that I want to get to at the end of our conversation, how and why that's been the problem. So we didn't really get into MDMA specifically. I didn't really get to offer this download that we're going to do today, you know.
Okay, I didn't realize that. So that was not discussed between you guys.
No, it wasn't. No, it was, no. And then, you know, Charles and I did another podcast that's available where, again, we just spoke generally. And, you know, Charles, as well as I do, that, you know, sometimes he likes to be sort of step back and be more kind of philosophical and not very confrontative. And that's just kind of his style and the way he works. And I respect that. And that's not the way you work. And that's not the way I work either. So, you know, it takes all of us maybe working together to kind of nudge consciousness along a little bit. That's how I'm looking at it. And I feel kind of confident that, you know, if I were to have a conversation with RFK Jr. about this, that he would learn a lot. And so, I think a lot of people would, which is the value of our conversation today.
100%. And I appreciate you correcting me on that. Thank you. And, you know, if at any point during this conversation I have something wrong, I welcome that. I think we'll start to see, as we delve deeper into this conversation, a through line as to why I'm suspicious of his public comments around MDMA with some other things. But I know you're going to take us there. So opening statements out of the way, where would you like to start us off on today's journey?
Okay, well, I'm resisting the desire to follow up on what you said about Joe Rogan, because he's another character in this. And yes, he, you know, there's a group of these podcasters that are very popular.
Yep.
And they're very entertaining and they're very clever, and they cover, a lot of times will cover some really interesting material. There's also plenty of room to critique them. And I'm thinking lately mostly about these three, Aubrey Marcus, and who I've been invited to be on his program, Joe Rogan, who I haven't connected with yet, and Jordan Peterson. Now, these are three characters who say very often have a lot of very exciting guests, and they say a lot of smart things, and they're all a little bit different in ways. But one way that they're all unified is that they all espouse what I call, what am I going to call it today? I'm going to call it the narrative, the enterprise narrative. There's a story about, you know, we're in the middle of this psychedelic renaissance. There's all kinds of media coverage and books being written, and they all tell a story, a narrative about how these psychedelic drugs came into society and why there was confusion about them in the 60s and 70s, and how great it is now that the government is finally approving some studies. There are certain people, there's this small, really small group of people that's behind this renaissance of psychedelics. They all tell the same story. And that story, Joe Rogan, that you're telling, if you ever get to listen to this, or Aubrey Marcus, and I hope this comes to your attention, because because I'd love to talk with your audience about this too. That's a false story. That's a false narrative that you're putting out. And so that makes me suspicious of your integrity, your intellectual honesty, and your integrity as a public speaker. And so I'm challenging you to listen to this material and share it with your viewers. So let me just put that out there. And now we can go back to my beginning, if you
May I
want.
speak to that rabble-rouser that I am? And I appreciate your speaking to them because they do tune into my podcast on the regular.
That's where they
So
get their good material.
yeah, exactly. I love that you pinpointed those three because I did hear Jordan Peterson mention in a recent interview that he's working with John Vervaeke, Santa Fe Institute. You know that that's one of the through lines that I follow. Did you ever watch the Matthew North video on Joe Rogan and Aubrey Marcus that I sent you?
Yes, I did. Now, Matthew North, that's the fellow who died.
Was murdered after that video came out. And what I just want to kind of, I'll just keep weaving this as a through line, is he was pointing to their connection, specifically through Aubrey, to Mossad, to the state of Israel. And again, looking at Bobby Kennedy, looking at, his relationship with Rabbi Shmuley and whatnot, just to kind of keep that alive as we have this conversation about MDMA and MAPS.
Yes. So, rabble rouser, I like to, because my experience in this subject is so extensive and broad and deep, I really like to rely mostly, if not solely, on what I personally know through direct experience. And when I looked at that Matthew North video that you sent me, I noticed some errors and I noticed some things that I couldn't really relate to with or speak with any authority about. I knew that he had some errors. I see errors in all the psychedelic stuff that I read. And I wished I could have known him to help him a little bit, you know, but I was impressed with his enthusiasm and his thoroughness. But he made some, there are a few of these researchers in this field that are up and coming. And some are very problematic. Like there's a fellow named Jan Irvin who's very who Matthew North was drawing a lot of material from. Jan is a kind of checkered guy, difficult, was a, you know, like not, I wouldn't say a colleague of mine, but he reached out to me and we spoke for, you know, a few years, and then he just got too unwieldy and difficult. And so I just try to leave him out of the conversation. It's already a hard subject to get into. You know, we don't need arrogance and obnoxious personalities and unresolved anger, you know, in the conversation. Deal with those in another way if we're gonna present this material. And then of course there's Vince Rado, who I think I connected you guys, and I'm really impressed with that guy's intelligence and his care. And he's another one of these researchers like us. Like a lot of people that want to know the dirt on, we love psychedelic drugs. We've experienced them. We know how amazing they can be and how important and how radically transformative to individuals and society they can be. But there's also an enterprise underway that has weaponized these substances and used them really against an effective countercultural movement. A humanistic, sustainable counterculture movement. And so one of the reasons that I'm, you know, kind of coming out, you know, my life has been secret. My involvement and interest in these substances for the last 43 years, is that what we said, has been secret because first of all, they've been illegal, and but also because my personal feeling is that that's how they're best deployed as sac, you know, they're sacraments. Sacraments means, you know, kind of secret, kind of outside the profane world of commerce and acquisitiveness and you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's they're secret substances. And that's been my orientation. But I really feel moved lately to speak out more because there are a lot of people getting hurt There are really important medicines that are being squandered, and our culture is once again at a real kind of crisis point, and we need all the help we can get. So let's get our voices out there. Let's teach discernment and discrimination to know the difference between when is a psychedelic drug like MDMA being deployed as a weapon, and when is it really being used in a sacramental way. And that's the same with ibogaine and ayahuasca and cannabis and LSD and psilocybin. These drugs have two aspects to them, more than two. Two basic ones in the for the advancement of human consciousness and evolution, and for the subjugation of it, and that we need to cultivate discernment between these two different poles. And that's why I'm speaking out and taking these risks that I'm doing, and but that's what I think we have to do. So.
And I'm grateful for your courage and for showing up today to bring us up to speed.
Yeah.
So, can we start with how you discovered MDMA and what brought you to MDMA the first time?
Yeah, well, I was just out of college 43 years ago. I graduated in 1981 from the University of California, and I was a student there of Frank Baran, who is a very important figure in modern psychedelic history, because he was one of the first researchers, also had intelligence connections. Let's make clear about that. But he was one of the most important psychologists of the last century in the study of creativity. He was the most cited professor of psychology in the University of California system. But he was best friends with Timothy Leary when they went to graduate school together. And it was Frank who turned Timothy Leary on to psychedelics. Not directly. Frank had an experience a year earlier, told Tim, this is what we're looking for. This is the agent that can help revolutionize American psychology and help us avert this wave of fascist authoritarianism that was beginning to sweep into the United States in the post-war period. A lot of psychologists had noted this growing authoritarianism.
And can you
So,
speak to this growing authoritarianism? Was it coming like post-World War II? Was this a Project Paperclip thing? What was he speaking to specifically?
yeah, well, it's all of those things. That's a whole book in itself, really. But for our more literate listeners, I would refer you to a great summary of this topic right here by John Dean, of all people. John Dean, who was Richard Nixon's attorney, and kind of turned on Nixon and helped that whole thing. That's another confusing part of history. But John Dean, in like 2006, wrote a really fantastic book called Conservatives Without Conscience, about the neoconservative movement and about the personality styles of these guys like Cheney and Rumsfeld and these people, this brutal kind of authoritarianism that subverted democracy. And John Dean writes that you can find just some of these chapters. It's called The Triumph of the Authoritarians. And he writes very intelligently about how a number of social scientists, beginning in the 1940s, were beginning to see in America some of the psychological characteristics that had recently swept through Europe with the triumph of Nazism. Excessive obedience to authority, conformity to authority, treating your fellow men, brothers and sisters, brutally. And there was a lot of research that was done, starting with really the most famous and in some ways important studies were accomplished by a man named Solomon Asch, who did these very important, they're called the Solomon Asch conformity studies. And he Solomon Asch showed that 75, 80% of a given population, and he was doing these studies at like the most elite schools, on the East Coast at Yale and Swarthmore, 75 to 80% of a given of a population of students will defy their own senses and lie in order to conform to a group opinion. That's obviously wrong. And that set off a whole wave of studies like that. And then there was another important one by Stanley Milgram, the famous, a movie was made, The Experimenter, I think, where subjects, they experimented, they showed that people would obey a person in a lab coat and administer potentially fatal electric shocks to a person as long as the person in the lab coat with the clipboard said, keep doing this, it's okay. The person in the other, that's receiving the shocks, ostensibly, it's all, Confederate screaming. No, it's a, and again, like 80% of the people would do this, would obey the authority. So these studies were going on, and a number of psychologists were concerned, like, holy shit, we just fought a war against that kind of mentality, and now it's happening here. And two of the brightest of that, of all those psychologists, were Timothy Leary and Frank Baran. They looked into this, the personality, the authoritarian personality, the personality of the person who conforms versus the personality of the much smaller percent that has their own internal locus of authority and control and defies the group and speaks the truth. And they were devoting their careers like, how do we get more of those kind of people? And so when Frank Baran, while studying writers, expatriate writers in Mexico, was turned on to the mushroom. This is in the late 50s. He thought, wow, this is the thing to unlock the personality, to really elevate it and help it evolve to this more independent judgment, creative, questioning authority. And that's who Frank was. And he so I was lucky to be his student. And in my last year, we got talking about psychedelic drugs. And he encouraged me that, Frank was the guy who started the project at Harvard with Leary. People think it was Richard Alpert, Ram Dass. No, Frank started it with Tim. And when it got a little too crazy, Frank left and went back to Berkeley, where he was a professor at the University of California for the rest of his life. And he thought it was time to resume psychedelic research again, that we'd learned from those mistakes. Tim and he were still best friends. There were errors, flaws, brilliance, courage. It was a whole lot of stuff going on. And Frank thought we could be wiser now and to make another attempt to get intelligent people, responsible people who recognize the sacredness of this and the importance for our culture. And so he kind of tapped me and said, why don't you, here, let's have a conference. Why don't you, I'll have the psychology department at the University of California sponsor it, and you do the work. And I was, I just started to get into this stuff, but I was very excited about it. I was on my way to graduate school to study the history of religion, but mostly focusing on meditation and shamanism and stuff like that. But I got turned on to psychedelics finally. And Frank said, do this. And so this is a long answer to your question, how does my MDMA thing start? Well, I organized this conference with some friends in Santa Cruz in the psychology department. It was amazing. This was before psychedelic conferences become a, cottage industry. I mean, there's like three a month now. They all charge a lot of money, and but this was a free conference. We did it just sending out mailings and, organized it in quickly in just a few months. And oh my God, there were like, about 100 speakers, all, a lot of the people who were involved in the first wave of psychedelics. Timothy Leary, Stanislav Grof, John Lilly, Oscar Janiger, Andrew Weil, like it was an all-star list of these people that loved what these substances could do. And about 1,000 people came, like out of nowhere. They mobbed the campus. And it was the first time all these people had gotten together and there was any sort of, conference like that to say, hey, what about all that stuff that happened in the 60s? And
What year was
so
this?
this was the summer of 1981. And it was a conference that we called Colloquium II, The Future of Consciousness Research. And that's where I met all these people that would then become very significant teachers for me. I met Timothy Leary there. And the two notable ones first were Timothy Leary and Stanislav Grof, who, your listeners probably know is widely considered one of the most experienced researchers of psychedelic drugs in psychiatry, and has authored a very elegant theory of mind based on his psychedelic research. And Stan and I hit it off, and so he invited me to come down to Esalen to be his assistant and his student. And so I called the University of Chicago and said, I'm going to wait a year. I'm going to go to Esalen. I'm going to do this other thing first. And I went down to Esalen and I was working with Stan, and it was one of the most amazing times of my life. And then Timothy Leary came to town, to Santa Cruz, just north of Esalen. And there, somebody, an associate of Timothy Leary, gave me some MDMA. And I had heard about it. And this was here it was, these capsules in my hand. I thought, okay. So I went back to Esalen and on Halloween took it. And oh my God, that was an amazing experience of, it was just like one of my teachers, Claudia Naranjo, said it induces a transient sanity because suddenly you are just freed of all your little petty, little neurotic, I'm 22 years old or something at the time. And all this stuff that you worry about, all the little hindrances and fetters in your consciousness and fears and just like gone. And you're just totally present. And when you're totally present, you love and you have empathy. And it was just incredible experience. And so afterwards, I told Stan, I said, wow, someone gave me this MDMA. And if we're gonna start another psychedelic movement or research, this is the one to really work with because it's not like LSD or mushrooms where you are confronted with your unconscious or confronted with these powerful mysteries. This is a very gradual thing. A gradual way to alter your consciousness and then to suddenly get this other reference point about what life can be like. And so Stan said, oh yeah, I know. Well, if you want to know more about that, he said, you have to go up and meet Alexander Shulgin. So again, Shulgin is like, now he's an icon. There's movies made about him, and he's a very, part of this renaissance that's celebrating all these characters. Well, I didn't. That was the first time I'd heard Shulgin's name, or maybe I'd heard his name, but Stan was saying you should go talk to Alexander Shulgin. So I was a good student. I did everything that my teacher said. So I hitchhiked up to Berkeley and went into Alexander Shulgin's, was just finished. He was teaching chemistry at the University of California there. And I went and I knocked on his office door and I said, I introduced myself. I'm Robert Forte, and I want to learn everything I can about psychedelic drugs. I'm a student of Frank Baran and Timothy and Stan Grof. And then he said, well, how can I help you, Robert? And I said, well, I had some of this MDMA, and it was really amazing. And here you're the guy. And it wasn't, MDMA wasn't illegal at the time. It's very not hardly anybody knew about it. I said, can I get some more of that from you? And he laughed and he said, no, I couldn't do that. And then we chatted for a little bit longer. And then he said to me, kind of leaned over again. He said, but I can teach you how to make it. And I thought, that's an interesting idea. And then anyway, this thing started to happen very quickly. Sooner than later, I was hitchhiking again. This guy had chemistry books in his back seat. And the Beatles, All You Need Is Love, was playing on the radio, we got into talking, and then I said, you guys, you want to make some drugs? And I said, it's legal, and they're and it, you know, and then you know, if another few months go by or whatever it was, and then I borrowed 500 bucks from my old best friend, and next thing we knew, we had the we made a few trips up to see Sasha again, and then next thing I knew, we had produced like a kilogram of totally pharmaceutically pure, perfectly legal MDMA that was made in the state-of-the-art laboratory, and it was that was a very fascinating moment. And so I began, my agreement with Sasha Shulgin was MDMA was not illegal. That it hadn't appeared in any of the government's drug networks. There's something called the Drug Abuse Warning Network, and it was below the radar. And we wanted to keep it that way. And so Sasha made me promise, which was perfect for me because that's just who I am anyway. Like, this is not a drug dealing thing. This is a way we want to seep this drug out into society and build a base of anecdotal evidence that shows how valuable it can be in psychotherapy. He says your MDMA is as good as it gets. He referred people to me, therapists, people in the Northern California area, mostly at first. And I provided MDMA for them, and then I began to conduct what I called a naturalistic study. It was a quasi-formal naturalistic study where I would give it to people. I had a couple people working with me. One was my girlfriend at the time, and we would give it to people and ask them to just write a report about what it did, and above all, keep it secret. We want to build this underground base. We don't want it's perfectly legal. It's safe if you take this much. I wasn't doing this to make money. I have my own money thing, and I was, for me, it was about consciousness. It was about research. It was about sharing something beautiful. And it was a marvelous time. And I met hundreds of amazing people. My people that I provided MDMA to were like, I could write a book about that and drop a lot of names of, best-selling authors or very famous people in, science or entertainment. I love to tell a story about how I turned Hunter Thompson onto it, after meeting Jack Nicholson and turning him on. I mean, these were just
Wait, you cannot gloss over turning Hunter Thompson onto MDNA when you met him with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, no. So it's like that. It was that kind of time in my life. Like, it was just magic and fun and
I do want to be clear that you were so on the forefront of this that you were the first one to give Hunter Thompson MDMA. I'm just wanting to make it clear that you were leading the charge. Is that accurate?
Well, I won't say I'm leading a charge, but I would say I was the first one to give it to Hunter. And it began a friendship. Hunter and I were friends, and over the next whatever 10 years or so, got a little dated. He kind of eroded quickly.
What was Hunter like on MDMA? Did it soften him? Was he just like a big love bug?
He was adorable. I just loved the guy. His outrageousness is sort of his public persona. But when you're just hanging out with him, yeah, he could be very outrageous, but he had just a brilliance and a kindness, and I really loved the guy. He was so smart, and he cared so much. And I'm very confused when I now, over the last whatever 20 years, read other things about him, identifying him with different stuff like snuff films and pedophilia, and that just doesn't really add up to the Hunter that I know. And that's a whole nother story. But my personal relationship with Hunter was really fun and really profound. I almost got him to write a book on the Kennedy assassination in 19 in 86, and we had one of the things I'm smoke because I had this fire 4 years ago that burned down all my library and all my backup computers, and had all these faxes from Hunter. We would, he was a midnight guy, and we would send faxes back and forth, and he was outrageous and funny, and So anyway, I got to know him. That was part of this thing. And so anyway, back to where we're going. Everybody that was part of that was a recipient of MDMA from my project, like I said, many very famous and outrageous people kept the secret. And a lot of just ordinary people, my friends, graduate students, I didn't go for, I was very, very careful, let's say. In fact, I was laughing about this the other day because one of the things, I'm a very healthy person and I knew that it was a heart stimulant. And I remember like one of my rules of the project was don't give it to anybody over 70. And I'm going to be 68 in a couple months. But anyway, so everybody was honored.
Will you stop using MDMA once you hit 70?
Well, I already kind of stopped using MDMA. You know, I used it quite a number of times in those early days. But when the whole thing changed, and it changed very quickly by like the mid 80s, 90s, when the whole context and you know, aura around MDMA changed, I kind of had enough of it. And I'm not a big drug user anyway. You know, to me, the psychedelics are kind of you know, used to punctuate things. And I'd never really, you know, I mean, I've been to my fair share of Grateful Dead concerts on various, you know, substances, and that's really fun. But I'm really very, you know, even though I have to say this because it's true, I'm just not a big, I use these things very cautiously. And so, you know, maybe once a year I can imagine doing it. I had some, whatever, it's still illegal. So back to the story that everybody kept the secret except one person. And this person is Rick Doblin, who my then partner gave it to. And it was a, to me, it was a, I didn't, you know, then he came and I met him and I just had a very kind of scary feeling about him, like,
Right off the bat.
right off the bat, yep.
And what qualities were you picking up on?
Just as a, you know, and just like he had a enthusiasm to make a lot of money. He was very glib about the spiritual or psychological value of psychedelics, but he was really just kind of a partier, interested to make a buck. And he will say this, you know, in an honest way. You can read things about him. You know, he was just like when I had met him, he had just, and this is something that you never see in the media that fawns over him. Like he was like Time Magazine called him one of the most important people of the last decade or something. And, you know, how this guy like had a vision of psychedelics could be helpful and devoted his life and got a Harvard PhD. And, you know, I mean, Rick and I have known each other since 1983, I think it is. Yeah. And, you know, the true story about him is very different than this media image that has been created about him. And so I'm hesitating now a little bit because I don't want this to be, I really want to just try to share this stuff from my heart, honestly. And I'm not like trying to diss him or, you know, judge him harshly. That's the kind of person he is. When I met him, he had just, and I still don't know the details of this, but this is never in the media, that he had just gotten off of a cocaine bust. He was a dropout or some returning student to a college in Florida, a new college in Florida. He came from a very wealthy family. He had a trust fund, and he was busted selling cocaine to kids in college, to undergraduates in college, you know. And somehow he was busted, but he was not convicted. Okay. And then he shows up at Esalen, just again because he loved drugs, and here was Groff, and his family gave him money to go to Esalen, and then he gets this MDMA. And very soon after he gets his MDMA, instead of keeping the secret, not only does he not keep the secret, he calls the media, he calls the newspapers, He calls Ronald Reagan's drug czar Carlton Turner, and he calls like anti-drug groups like the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. And he tells them all that there is this new phenomenon. There's this new drug that's legal, a love drug that therapists in Northern California are using. And it's, it kind of comes out of the Esalen. He kind of snitched on the whole program and start and somehow appoints himself or gets appointed through by the media. Again, he's a guy with like no qualifications. He doesn't even have an undergraduate degree. He's got a cocaine bust. He's a rich, like hedonistic party guy. And suddenly he is splashed all over the media as this drug popularizer of this new, not illegal drug. And he makes, I could like I, someone just sent me, I have one article. Like it's, this is this will kind of give you an idea. Can I do this here?
Yeah, if you just click share at the bottom, it should work.
Okay, let's see. Whoops. I might mistakenly get us cut off. You're there. This is Zoom. Okay, I'm not able to do this, but
Do you want to? Is it something you can send me the link to?
it's an
Or send
email I
me
got.
the
Yeah, I
file?
could send you the file. Let's see, go back to here. Yeah, give me a second here. Okay. Forward to which one?
Send it to my
Proton
Proton
mail?
mail. Yeah.
Okay, so this is just an example. This is one of the many articles that appeared across the country.
So how did you and the people who were working on the project with you respond to Doblin going public the way that he did?
Okay, well, first, I want to get you back on my screen here. I don't know why I can't do this.
Usually, if you click Zoom, you'll get me back. But just to complicate things, I also haven't received it.
All right, it's
Isn't
coming through.
technology fun? Okay, I got it.
Okay, you got that. Why can't I get you back on my?
Okay, while you're figuring that out, I'm going to share the screen so that we can see.
Oh, there you are. Good. Okay.
Okay, so this is the article. Can you see it?
Yes, I can see it. And that
New
is an
guru
example.
pitches ecstasy, the drug labeled both a killer and medical tool.
You can see in here the last paragraph, a Harvard psychiatrist with whom he says he is working. I wish he'd leave my name out of these things. I mean, in this very first wave, Doblin was a bother. We were like, what the fuck are you doing? But
Was
then.
he, did you guys eject him from the community? And may I ask the date when this article came out?
That article, I don't know when that article came out, but this period is like I think he snitched on us in the summer of 84. So it was just a few months after he got his first dose.
And how did you guys respond when he snitched?
Like, what the fuck are you doing? What the fuck are you doing? And he came up with these things like, well, I just wanted to try to get ahead of the illegalization movement and try to show people how good this can be. But really, it was just like he was making money. He made like a quick, couple hundred grand or something doing this, selling it underground. And And then it was weird, like how, the media, the way they fawned over him. and television media also. And I just started to be suspicious of something happening here, and I needed to begin to kind of step back. And I feel like now I should take a little detour for just a moment, because with the stuff I'm going to get into now is I'm going to present my, it's more than just a theory, but I'm going to discuss the conspiracies in American drug policy. And I need to say at the beginning here that there are a lot of people, young people, very smart people who have been tricked by the weaponization of the phrase conspiracy theory. That, oh, that's a conspiracy theory is like a way to denigrate something. And you really have to understand that that is a linguistic weapon that has been deployed by the CIA to deflect inquiry into governmental conspiracies, of which there are many. And there's a whole industry out there to disparage people that look behind the veil of the modern information industry. Oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Oh, that's a, oh, that's, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, da da da. So, if you're listening to this and you're one of those people that has been made allergic to conspiracy theories, you're going to really have to smarten up, because there's no way to understand history, particularly modern history, or any of these issues that we're going to get into with drug policy. You're not going to understand the reason that America has been in a nearly constant state of war since the post-World War II period. You're not going to understand the Cold War. You're not going to understand the Vietnam War. You're not going to understand the war on drugs. You're not going to understand the specific policies that are instituted that govern psychedelic drugs unless you understand these theories of these conspiracies and understand the evidence that supports them. So I always say, one of the first, really great examples of this kind of inquiry concerns the heroin business. And you have to understand that government, that the United States does not make drugs illegal to protect people. That's a fallacy. That's a thing you have to just put aside and look at the evidence. Drugs are illegal. We're particularly talking about the so-called recreational drugs, including all the psychedelic drugs. These drugs are illegal. Cocaine, they're illegal because when they're illegal, criminal organizations that are beholden, connected with the government, control their commerce.
That does it for the first half of my conversation with Robert Forte. As you are inspired to pick up the second half of our super juicy conversation about MDMA, MAPS, and Rick Doblin, you can find that over on my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannykatz.locals.com and patreon.com/dannykatz. At both communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, plus oodles of bonus content, plus the ever gratifying knowledge that you are supporting a content creator in keeping on keeping on. I'm also reminding you once again to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com, and reminding you that the best way to safeguard you and yours from propaganda, media manipulation, and groupthink, which the World Economic Forum has bizarrely correctly pinpointed as the number one threat facing humans on this planet, I'm inviting you to check out my Pop Propaganda Media Literacy course for teens and grown-ups alike. The course is appropriate for humans ages 14 and up. It will teach you how propaganda works, how this matrix machine is dependent upon propaganda to continue to function, how to recognize propaganda, media manipulation, how to safeguard and expand our critical thinking, our confidence, our agency, such that we can walk through the world impervious to the attempts of the social engineers to manipulate, divide, control, and enslave us. You can find that course through my website, DannyKatz.com. As soon as you register, you get instant lifetime access. There's nothing like this on the planet, and I promise you'll dig it. That does it. Thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Locals and the Patreons. Have a rockin' day.